Ahead and get started. Really a very interesting and exciting morning. I hope you'll find the afternoon to be equally educational and interesting. We again have an outstanding collection of speakers for you. And I'm going to turn things over to our moderator, Dr. Denis Therrien. Dr. Therrien is the James McGill Professor of Computer Sciences. And I met Denis in his role as Vice Principal for Research and International Relations, and the critical end from that very long and impressive title was the international relations side. So he was the first, I believe, at McGill to have that, and really was, for me, an inspiration and a leader in bringing a global vision to the university and a lot of support for me trying to build global health programs. And so I'm really quite honored to have him moderate this session. If I were to read his many awards and accomplishments, it would fill the entire time. So I will just turn it over to Denis to run the session. Denis.
Merci beaucoup, Tim, pour tous les mensonges que tu racontes à mon sujet. Bienvenue pour cette session d'après-midi. You made the right choice. I'm just coming out from outside. It's pouring rain, and I even think it will snow before the end of the afternoon, so we're much better here, I can tell you that. For the panel of this afternoon, we have three giant speakers, and any one of them could certainly fill the afternoon, and it would be extremely interesting. The way that I suggest that we organize the panel, well, if I suggest, it's going to be like that. We're going to have each of them coming. I will introduce the first one. He comes and makes his talk for 20 minutes. And then I introduce the second, we'll have the 20-minute talk, and the third 20-minute talk, and then we'll have the questions at the end so that we can have a chance to interrelate the talks and confront perhaps some of the positions and so on. So the first speaker, Dr. Peter Singer, that's an amazing CV. The few lines I have here are quite fascinating. Professor of Medicine, Sun Life Financial Chair in Bioethics, Director at the McLaughlin Rotman Center for Global Health from the University Health Network and University of Toronto. His research is on life sciences and the developing world, how technologies make the transition from lab to village, which I thought was quite an interesting description of your work. In 2007, Singer received the Michael Smith Prize as Canada's Health Research of the Year in Population Health and Health Services. He's a member of a long list of very prestigious organizations, published millions of research articles, 50 million in research grants, trained 70 students, member of the Scientific Advisory Board of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, Grand Challenges for Global Health Initiative, an organization that plays quite a big role today, has advised the UN Secretary General Office, the Government of Canada, and so on and so forth. Now, listen to this. He studied internal medicine at University of Toronto, medical ethics at University of Chicago, public health at Yale University, and management at Harvard Business School. One could think of a worse track record than that. Well, Dr. Singer, it's a privilege and my honor to be to moderate you this afternoon.
Merci, Denis. Je suis très honoreux d'être ici avec des amis, avec Jody, who's doing such outstanding work here at McGill's Institute for Health and Social Policy, and Henri, who's doing such great work at ISTPC. And it's great to get to meet Tim as well and this fantastic global health program that you have. I think that this it's really been an amazing morning. When you just reflect back on the talks that we heard about the potential that we have in Canada to really make a difference in global health, I think it's just amazing. If you don't mind my saying so up front, I'm not sure that that potential yet is fully networked, that we've fully reached our potential as a country in terms of bringing those pieces together. But we have a great platform on which to build. For example, the unbelievable work of IDRC that Michael referred to earlier. And in terms of what he had to say, if you have a look next Monday afternoon at www.grandchallenges.ca, you'll see one of these partnerships that Michael was talking about. So it's always great to come to this beautiful campus. As you know, I'm based at U of T, or as Tim refers to it, that's Ontario's McGill. But it's great to be here, and to, in particular, to see so many students and so many young people, because if we are to get our house in order and really achieve what we can as a country in global health, it's actually going to depend on young people, very much like those in this room. So a special thanks to all of you for coming. Now, this panel on innovative solutions is really a combination of the earlier sessions, because innovative solutions require partnerships, they require innovative technologies, they require innovative social and business models, and we've touched upon some great examples of many of those things earlier in the day. And when it comes to global health, innovative solutions also need something else. They need innovative thinking, which means breaking out of old structures and creating new ones, making better use of the resources that we have and developing ones that we don't. And it also means we need countries like Canada to play an even greater role in global health. And it's that role, the role of Canada in global health, that I'd like to talk to you about in just a few vingtaine de minutes cet après-midi. I believe there are unique opportunities for Canada in global health to have an impact, to make a difference, and to redefine our role in the world. 9 years ago, as you know, world leaders set some far-sighted Millennium Development Goals to free a major portion of humanity from the shackles of extreme poverty, hunger, disease by 2015. And as you know, three of those goals involved global health, maternal health, child health, and combating HIV/AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, and other diseases, which together continue to rob entire countries of their future. I mean, if you just think about that point that came up this morning, you know, if you wanted to make sure people stayed poor forever, if that was your goal, if you were a misanthropist, what would you do? You'd just make sure that a billion kids every year didn't get enough micronutrients, had worse intellectual and physical development for their whole lives, worse human capital, worse economic attainment, worse school attainment. It's a great way to make sure that people are locked into poverty together forever. And UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, I think, caught the urgency of this situation when, in his foreword to the 2009 Millennium Development Report, he said, "We've made important progress in this effort and have many successes on which to build, but we've been moving too slowly to meet our goals," end quote. And the statistics really bear that out. You know, today, a woman in the developing world is still 50 times as likely to die in pregnancy and childbirth. A child born in the developing world is still 13 times as likely to die under the age of 5. And shocking as those ratios are, they're almost twice as bad in sub-Saharan Africa. So how can that be right? How can that be fair? Well, you know what? It's not right, and it's not fair. And so, to my way of thinking, global health is really the mother of all ethical issues. You know, and make no mistake, in an interconnected world, those problems that I describe are not their problems as opposed to our problems. We is they, as experiences like H1N1 and issues like chronic disease that were mentioned earlier that interconnect us make very clear. And in light of these challenges, you know, the question is, will Canada rise to meet them? And what might our unique contribution be to global health? Well, it's not likely to come from what we spend.
At the moment, Canada spends about $580 million a year in global health, which is about 2.6% of total world development funding on global health. And that's a pretty small percentage. So if our leadership doesn't come from the amount we spend, it needs to come from the way that we think, the quality of our ideas. Put another way, if we don't lead with fresh thinking, we won't lead at all. But where Canadians do lead, other countries will join and partner and follow, including with their dollars, I'm convinced. So it's time to make our mark on the global stage. 50 years ago, Canada did just that when Lester Pearson won a Nobel Peace Prize for his role in resolving the Suez Crisis. Pearson's proposal to create peacekeeping forces wearing the blue helmets of the United Nations revolutionized international relations, raised Canada's reputation in global affairs. I'm not arguing that our play 50 years later is peacekeeping, because obviously there's been a lot of changes in that particular area, but I think it's a great metaphor for what we can do and what we should do. And just as this country formulated a new way to address global conflict through peacekeeping, today we have the opportunity to address global health challenges through innovation. So what would our brand or reputation be? It would be that Canada helps solve global challenges using innovation. We would do so both directly and by fostering innovation in developing countries. This would be a unique contribution for our country, one in which we could lead the way and inspire others to follow. Think of it as expanding beyond blue helmets to white lab coats. And Canada brings impressive efforts, assets to such an effort. And I think there's no better demonstration of that than the talks we've already heard this morning. And I really want to compliment you, Tim, for picking such fantastic examples of Canadian contribution to global health. And I'm sure we'll hear some more this afternoon. You know, we've got some of the best scientists in the world conducting some of the best science, world-class university system, and some of those people, as I've mentioned, are right here in this room. We have the incredible energy and enthusiasm of today's students to address global health challenges. As I travel across this country, I'm amazed and inspired by the ingenuity, energy, and commitment of today's students in wanting to solve global health problems. And if you look at, for instance, the data on the uptake of the Consortium of Universities in Global Health, Tim, which I know you've been involved in, you see that there's incredibly rising demand, and I think you see the same thing in campuses in Canada. This is an extremely interconnected, technologically adept, globally aware generation, and anybody that says campus idealism died in the 60s just isn't setting foot in our campuses today. Young people are just looking for an outlet, I think, for their idealism. And focusing on Canada's contribution on addressing global challenges through innovation, I would argue, addresses that need. We're also home to more than 15,000 scientific and health-related professionals from developing countries who could provide ready-made links to those communities. David Miliband, the British Secretary of State for Foreign and Commonwealth Affairs, recently gave a speech in which he said something interesting. He said, quote, "The scientific world is becoming interdisciplinary, but the biggest interdisciplinary leap we need to make is across the boundaries of politics and science." And he's right. As Miliband points out, science and innovation can help to answer some of the foreign policy challenges that diplomacy cannot, by forging consensus where there's political division, by bringing together scientists and young people from around the world to address common challenges. Canada could lead this effort with respect to global health. Now, of course, we need to find the right balance between the short-term efforts at humanitarian and emergency relief, such as our response to the tragedy in Haiti, mid-term efforts to strengthen health systems in developing countries, and the longer-term sustainable solutions provided through innovation. We also need to find the right combination of technological, scientific, social, and business innovation, and best if they're integrated and combined. So technological innovation, of course, is new products, services, finding a vaccine for malaria, or making vaccines such that they can be needle-free or could be given only once close to birth. Kish's example is a great example of technological innovation. But sometimes, even when an effective product exists, there aren't the services or institutions needed to get those products to people. So you need social and indeed business model innovation, examples of which might be the accelerated child survival model, intermittent management of childhood illness, Global Fund, Gavi, some of the examples we were hearing about this morning, LEN's network of African researchers and tapping into the biodiversity and figuring out how to commercialize domestic ideas, that can be thought of as a type of social business institutional innovation in addition to the important technological work around finding leads for parasitic diseases. And, there are even more fundamental social forces, obviously, and I'm hoping and sure we'll learn, hear more about this from Jody, issues of how gender roles really drive a lot of those 360,000 maternal deaths. You know, when women have to check with their husbands in the city before going to the hospital when they deliver, and other fundamental issues in gender equity and gender roles, or how religious suspicions impede polio eradication, for example, in Nigeria. And I just want to reinforce Michael's mention of that fantastic IDRC supplement in that Open Access Biomed Central journal, which really looks at the social forces that impede getting vaccines to people who need them. So what's really needed is a balanced approach, combining technological, scientific, social, and business innovation. What might that look like? Let me just use one quick focusing example, and let me zero in on the example of point-of-care diagnostics, and we could have picked many, many examples. So one of the biggest challenges in averting child deaths in the developing world is a lack of effective diagnostic services at the bedside where these services are needed. You know, picking out the child with a fever who has severe malaria and who will end up as one of the million kids under five who die of malaria, or one of the million people under five, most of whom are kids in sub-Saharan Africa, who die of malaria. When there's, 500 million cases or whatever of malaria, 1 million deaths, picking out that needle in a haystack requires a point-of-care diagnostic. And if you treat empirically, as we do in many parts of the developing world, you breed resistance. And it's troubling to see artemisinin resistance emerging now in malaria treatment, not to mention the costs and other issues. So if we were to develop a new diagnostic tool, for instance, that could be used not in the laboratory where you get the results 3 days later with that heavy infrastructure, but a point-of-care test, in the field, for instance, a multi-channel multiplex test to diagnose the cause of fever in a child under five, that could save hundreds of thousands of lives. And actually, there's a decision model in a supplement to Nature that, depending on the assumptions you use, shows that you would save between 100,000 and 300,000 lives of children under five in minimal infrastructure conditions in malaria alone. So we also, in addition to striking the right balance between technological and social innovation, because you will have noticed that a point-of-care diagnostic would totally revolutionize also the health delivery model for the delivery of that technology, we also need to strike the right balance between Canadian innovation and innovation that occurs in the developing world itself. After all, if you asked yourself the counterfactual question, how would we make sure a country stayed poor forever, after you were finished depriving young children between conception and age two of micronutrients, probably the next thing you would do is make sure that the health outcomes of people in developing countries remain dependent on charity from rich countries. And how would you do that? Very simple. Just make sure that none of the bright ideas that occur domestically in the developing world about solving one's own problems and innovating against one's own problems actually find their way into products and services that can be applied in those local settings. And actually, Eliane spoke to this. This is the opposite of what she was talking about. And we're pretty good at doing that. We've actually surveyed what we call stagnant technologies in I think, 8 research institutions throughout Africa. A graduate student, Ken Simuyu, has done that. And he finds that there's no lack of innovation. There's no lack of talent. Talent is global. There's no lack of ideas. There's not even a lack of research conducted, but it gets stuck in research institutions. And don't get me wrong, this isn't Silicon Valley killer apps, generally speaking, but it's good ideas like an incinerator for medical waste in Uganda, like a dipstick for schistosomiasis in Ghana, a dipstick test. They just do not leave the laboratory. They stagnate there. So, what could we do? Well, you could think about developing a platform like the one Eliane was talking about, or the Mars Center in Toronto, or accelerators that are in any of our large knowledge-based cities, to really help, if you will, defragment those ideas, pull them out of the laboratory, and bring them to the point where private investors might actually be interested. If you were a venture capitalist, even a social venture capitalist, and you wanted to invest in innovation in Africa, African innovation against African problems, where would you go? You would have no idea where you should go and no way to find that flow of innovation. So defragmenting those platforms, I think, could be really important. Imagine a Mars Center in Tanzania, for instance. And guess what? It's starting to happen. Tanzania's science minister, Peter Msola, recently told a World Bank conference his country is planning a life science convergence center. He said the center is, quote, expected to strengthen its health innovation system, and in particular, the health innovation system of Tanzania, and in particular, commercialize health biotechnology products, end quote. It will also, quote, co-locate science, business, and capital providers for the very first time in Tanzania to enhance commercialization of life science-related technologies, end quote. So what would this mean? Well, it would mean breaking the impasse that keeps these poor countries poor. It would mean unlocking the continent's potential, and it would create a pathway to prosperity, jobs, and better health. Well, you may say, that's all and good, but what's in it for us? Why should we do this? Let me just make 4 quick points. Firstly, Canada will help solve important problems plaguing 5 billion people in the developing world. Think about Kish's passion when he found the one of his 4 or 5 technologies that could have huge impacts on millions of people. Think about that in the context of those imaging studies that we heard about, and focusing actually on a problem that plagues a billion people, micronutrient nutrition and brain development. Nobody has data on that. Why not? Think about the opportunity to do good with science. Secondly, Canada would develop solutions that would benefit us domestically. Think about H1N1. Think about Aboriginal health, which, by the way, is a very important proof point for global health, how we deal domestically with Aboriginal health. Thirdly, think about traditional models of international development, which are increasingly called into question. You know, for example, Dabisa Moyo's diagnostic of dead aid. Well, there's a diagnostic, but there's no real way forward. Innovation is a way forward. And finally, this isn't simply a humanitarian exercise. It's also a commercial enterprise in the long term. And that's a topic I know Henri will speak to. And so I won't spend more time than that. Just to say that 5 years ago, we used to call the developing world in pharmaceutical circles, quote unquote, the rest of the world. Well, now the rest of the world is the world. If you look at any large food or pharmaceutical company, where do you think their growth is coming from? It's coming from India, it's coming from China, and in the future, in the not too distant future, it will be coming from Africa. And I think these issues are very important. Now, in Budget 2008, the Government of Canada announced the Development Innovation Fund to, quote, create breakthrough discoveries with the potential to significantly improve the lives of millions in the developing world. So when you put all that together, the passion of the young people, the IDRC, our human capital, our universities, our slowly growing commercial expertise, which could be growing more quickly in the sort of work Henri is doing, our commitment to equity that we'll hear from, I think, more from Jody. When you put all that together and you throw in the Development Innovation Fund, you've got a really, really powerful combination of assets And now we've just got to figure out how to make it work together in a whole-of-Canada approach so we can accomplish our full potential. Next month, of course, Canada hosts the G8 and the G20, which provide great opportunities to begin this path in terms of our role in the world. So in closing, I just want to say that it was on this date in 1948 that the XP-86 officially broke the sound barrier, demolishing old boundaries, stretching the realm of the possible, at a time when half of the aeronautical engineers said it was impossible, and there were those who pushed ahead, and in doing so, opened up a whole new vista of opportunity and exploration, including spaceflight. Today, we too need to push beyond our invisible borders in global health and in innovation. We need to refuse to accept the status quo. We need to refuse to accept the sort of shocking and unethical disparities in health between rich and poor countries that I cited earlier by way of data points. We need to refuse to accept the ethics that says it's all right for my daughters and my son to live to be 80, but if they happen to be born in some rural parts of sub-Saharan Africa, they'd live to be 40. That's just not okay, and we can do something about it, and innovation is a key to that lock. So if there was ever a time for innovative partnerships, innovative technologies, innovative solutions, it's right now. And if there was ever a challenge that deserved our collective contribution, it's global health. And I believe we already have the institutions and the individuals to make a difference. Now it's time to supply or broaden the innovation and to create a sonic boom of our own. Thank you very much for your attention. I look forward to the discussion.